The traffic had scarcely begun. It was almost 6 hours till game time. He turned off the road onto the parking lot at the media entrance, and there was a cop he had to talk to. Cotty had already broken off and was now circling a few blocks away. Marvin stopped the van and rolled his window down. "Howdy," he said to the cop. Officer Pete Dawkins of the Denver City Police was already cold despite the fact that he was a native Coloradan. He was supposed to guard the media and VIP gate, a post he'd been stuck with only because he was a very junior officer. The senior guys were in warmer spots.
"Who are you?" Dawkins asked.
"Tech staff," Russell replied.
"This is the media gate, right?"
"Yeah, but you're not on my list."
There was a limited number of available spaces in the VIP lot, and Dawkins couldn't just let anyone in.
"Tape machine broke in the A unit over there," Russell explained with a wave. "We had to bring down a backup."
"Nobody told me," the police officer observed.
"Nobody told me either until 6 last night. We had to bring the goddamn thing down from Omaha."
Russell waved his clipboard rather vaguely. In the back, Gone was scarcely breathing.
"Why didn't they fly it down?"
"'Cause FedEx don't work on Sunday, man, and the damn thing's too big to get through the door of a Lear."
"I ain't complaining, man. I'm Chicago tech staff, okay? I'm network. I get triple time and a half of this shit. Away from home, special event, weekend overtime."
"That sounds pretty decent," Dawkins observed.
"Better than a week's normal pay, man."
"Keep talking, officer."
Russell grinned.
"This is a buck and a quarter a minute, you know."
"You must have a hell of a union."
"We sure do."
Marvin laughed.
"You know where to take it?"
"No problem, sir."
Russell pulled off. Gone let out a long breath as the van started moving again. He'd listened to every word, sure that something would go disastrously wrong. Dawkins watched the van pull away. He checked his watch and made a notation of his own on his clipboard. For some reason, the captain wanted him to keep track of who arrived when. It didn't make sense to Dawkins, but the captain's ideas didn't always make sense, did they? It took a moment for him to realize that the ABC van had Colorado tags. That was odd, he thought, as a Lincoln Town Car pulled up. This one was on his list. It was the president of the NFL's American Conference. The VIPs were supposed to be pretty early, probably, Dawkins thought, so they could settle into their skyboxes and start their drinking early. He'd also drawn security at the president's party the night before and watched every rich clown in Colorado get sloppy drunk, along with various politicians and other very important people. Mostly assholes, the young cop thought, having watched them, from all over America. He supposed that Hemingway was right after all. The rich just have more money. 200 yards away, Russell parked the van, set the brake, and left the engine on. Gone went in back. The game was scheduled to start at 4:20 local time. Major affairs always ran late, Ibrahim judged. He'd assumed a start time of 4:30. To that, he added another half hour, setting T0 at 5 o'clock Rocky Mountain Standard Time. Arbitrary numbers always had zeros in them, after all, and the actual time of the detonation had been set weeks before, precisely on the first hour after game start. The device did not have a very sophisticated anti-tamper device. There was a crude one set on each access door, but there hadn't been time to do anything complicated, and that, Gone thought, was a good thing. The gusting northeast wind was rocking the van, and a delicate tumbler switch might not have been a good idea after all. For that matter, he realized rather belatedly, just slamming the door closed on the van might have...
"What else have you failed to consider?" he wondered.
Gone reminded himself that all such moments brought up the most frightening of thoughts. He swiftly ran over everything he had done to this point. Everything had been checked 100 times and more. It was ready. Of course it was ready. Hadn't he spent months of careful preparation for this? The engineer made a last check of his test circuits. All were fine. The cold had not affected the batteries that badly. He connected the wires to the timer. Or tried to. His hands were stiff from the cold and quivered from the emotion of the moment. Gone stopped. He took a moment to get control of himself and attached them on the second try, screwing down the nut to hold them firmly in place. And that, he decided, was that. Gone closed the access door, which set the simple tamper switch, and backed away from the device. No, he said to himself, it is no longer a device. That it? Russell asked.
Yes, Marvin,
Gone answered quietly. He moved forward into the passenger seat.
Then let's leave.
Marvin watched the younger man get out and reached across to lock the door. Then he exited the van and locked his. They walked west, past the big network uplink vans with their huge dish antennas. They had to be worth millions each, Marvin thought, and every one would be wrecked, along with the TV weenies, just like the ones who had made a sporting event of his brother's death. Killing them didn't worry him a bit. Not one little bit. In a moment, the bulk of the stadium shielded them from the wind. They continued across the parking lot, past the ranks of early arriving fans and the cars which were pulling onto the lot, many of them from Minnesota, full of fans dressed warmly, carrying peanuts and wearing hats, some of them adorned with horns. Cotty and the rental car were on a side street. He simply slid over from the driver's seat, allowing Marvin to get behind the wheel. Traffic was now becoming thick, and to avoid the worst of it, Russell took an alternate route he'd scouted out the previous day.
You know, it really is a shame messing with the game like this.
What do you mean? Cotty asked.
This is the fifth time the Vikings have made it to the Super Bowl. This time it looks like they're gonna win. That Wills kid they have running for them is the best since Sayers, and because of us, nobody'll see it happen.
Too bad.
Russell shook his head and grinned at the irony of it all. Neither Cotty nor Gone bothered to reply, but Russell hadn't expected them to. They just didn't have much sense of humor, did they? The motel parking lot was nearly empty. Everyone staying there must have been a fan of one sort or another, Marvin thought, as he opened the door.
All packed?
Yes.
Gone traded a look with the commander. It was too bad, but it could not be helped. The room hadn't been made up yet, but that was no big thing. Marvin went into the bathroom, closing the door behind him. When the American emerged, he saw that both Arabs were standing.
Ready?
Yes, Cotty said.
Could you get my bag down, Marvin?
Sure.
Russell turned and reached for the suitcase that lay on the metal shelf. He didn't hear the steel bar that struck the back of his neck. His short but powerful frame dropped to the cheap all-weather carpet on the floor. Cotty had struck hard, but not hard enough to kill, the commander realized. He was weakening by the day. Gone helped him move the body back into the bathroom where they laid him face up. The motel was a cheap one, and the bathroom was small, too small for their purposes. They'd hoped to set him in the tub, but there wasn't room for both men to stand. Instead, Cotty simply knelt by the American's side. Gone shrugged his disappointment and reached for a towel from the rack. He wrapped the towel around Russell's neck. The man was more stunned than unconscious, and his hands were beginning to move. Gone had to move quickly. Cotty handed him the steak knife that he'd removed from the coffee shop after dinner the previous night. Gone took it and cut deeply into the side of Russell's neck, just below the right ear. Blood shot out as though from a hose, and Ibrahim pushed the towel back down to keep it from splashing on his clothes. Then he did the same thing to the carotid artery on the left side. Both men held the towel down, almost as though to stanch the blood flow. It was at that moment that Marvin's eyes came completely open. There was no comprehension in them. There was no time for him to understand what was happening. His arms moved, but each man used all his weight to hold them down and prevented the American from accomplishing anything. He didn't speak, though his mouth opened, and after a last accusing look at Gone, the eyes went dreamy for a moment, then rolled back. By this time, Cotty and Gone were leaning back to avoid the blood that now filled the grooves between the bathroom tiles. Ibrahim pulled back the towel, The blood was trickling out now, and was not a concern. The towel was quite sodden, however. He tossed it into the tub. Kati handed him another.
I hope God will be merciful to him, Gon said quietly.
He was a pagan. It was too late for recriminations.
Is it his fault that he never met a godly man?
Wash, Kati said. There were two sinks outside the bathroom. Each man lathered his hands thoroughly, checking his clothes for any sign of blood. There was none.
What will happen to this place when the bomb goes off? Kati asked.
Gon thought about that.
This close. It will be outside the fireball, but...
He walked to the windows and pulled the drapes back a few centimeters. The stadium was readily visible, and a direct line of sight made it easy to say what would happen.
The thermal pulse will set it afire, and then the blast wave will flatten the building. The whole building will be consumed.
You're sure?
Completely. The effects of the bomb are easy to predict.
Good. Kati removed all the travel documents and identification he and Gon had used to this point. They'd have to clear customs inspection, and they had already tempted fate enough. The surplus documents they tossed in a trash can. Gon got both bags and took them out to the car. They checked the room once more. Kati got into the car. Gon closed the door for the last time, leaving the Do Not Disturb card on the knob. It was a short drive to the airport, and their flight left in 2 hours. The parking lot filled up rapidly. By 3 hours before game time, much to Dawkins' surprise, the VIP lot was filled. Already the pregame show had begun. He could see a team wandering around the lot with a minicam, interviewing the Vikings fans who had converted one entire half of the parking lot into a giant tailgate party. There were white vapor trails rising from charcoal grills. Dawkins knew that the Vikings fans were slightly nutty, but this was ridiculous. All they had to do was walk inside. They could have any manner of food and drink, and consume it in 68-degree air, sitting on a cushioned seat, but no. They were proclaiming their toughness in air that couldn't be much more than 5 degrees Fahrenheit. Dawkins was a skier and had worked his way through college as a ski patrol at one of the Aspen slopes. He knew cold, and he knew the value of warmth. You couldn't impress cold air with anything. The air and wind simply didn't notice.
How are things going, Pete?
Dawkins turned.
No problem, Sarge. Everybody on the list is checked off. I'll spell you for a few minutes. Go inside and warm up for a while. You can get coffee at the security booth just inside the gate.
Thanks. Dawkins knew that he'd need something. He was going to be stuck outside for the whole game, patrolling the lot to make sure nobody tried to steal something. Plainclothes officers were on the lookout for pickpockets and ticket scalpers, but most of them would get to go inside and watch the game. All Dawkins had was a radio. That was to be expected, he thought. He had less than 3 years on the force. He was still almost a rookie. The young officer walked up the slope toward the stadium, right past the ABC minivan he'd checked through. He looked inside and saw the Sony tape machine. Funny. It didn't seem to be hooked up to anything. He wondered where those two techies were, but getting coffee was more important. Even polypropylene underwear had its limits, and Dawkins was as cold as he had ever remembered. Kati and Gon returned the car to the rental agency and took the courtesy bus to the terminal, where they checked in their bags for the flight, then headed in to check their flight's status. Here they learned that the American MD-80 for Dallas-Fort Worth was delayed. Weather in Texas, the clerk at the desk explained. There was ice on the runways from the storm that had just skirted past Denver the previous night.
I must make my connection to Mexico. Can you book me through another city? Gon asked.
We have one leaving for Miami, same departure time as your flight to Dallas. I can book you a connecting flight in Miami. The ticket agent tapped the data into her terminal. There's a 1 hour layover.
Oh, okay, it's only a 15-minute difference into Mexico City.
Could you do that, please? I must make my connection.
Both tickets?
Yes, excuse me.
No problem.
The young lady smiled at her computer. Gone wondered if she'd survive the event. The huge glass windows faced the stadium, and even at this distance, the blast wave.
Maybe, he thought, if she ducked fast enough.
But she'd already be blinded from the flash. Such pretty dark eyes, too. A pity.
Here you go. I'll make sure they switch the bags over, she promised him.
That Gone took with a grain of salt.
Thank you.
The gate is that way, she pointed.
Thank you once more.
The ticket agent watched them head off. The young one was pretty cute, she thought. But his big brother, or boss, she wondered, looked like a sourpuss. Maybe he didn't like to fly.
Well, Cotty asked, the connecting flight roughly duplicates our schedule. We've lost a quarter-hour buffer time in Mexico. The weather problem is localized. There should be no further difficulty.
The terminal was very nearly empty. Those people who wished to leave Denver were evidently waiting for later flights so that they might watch the game on TV, and the same appeared to be true of arriving flights, Ibrahim saw. There were scarcely 20 people in the departure lounge.
Okay, I can't reconcile the schedules here either, Goodley said. In fact, I'd almost say we have a smoking gun.
How so? Ryan asked.
Narmanov was only in Moscow 2 days last week, Monday and Friday. Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday he was in Latvia, Lithuania, the western Ukraine, and then a trip down to Volgograd for some local politicking. Friday's out because of when the message came over, right? But Monday our friend was in the Congress building practically all day. I don't think they met last week, but the letter implies that they did. I think we got a lie here.
Show me, Jack said. Goodley spread his data out on Ryan's desk. Together they went over the dates and itineraries.
Well, isn't that interesting, Jack said after a few minutes. That son of a bitch.
Persuasive? Goodley wanted to know. Completely? The deputy director shook his head. No.
Why not?
It's possible that our data is incorrect. It's possible that they met on the sly, maybe last Sunday when Andrei Ilyich was out at his dacha. One swallow doesn't make a spring, Jack said with a nod toward the snow outside. We need to make a detailed check on this before it goes any farther. But what you've uncovered here is very, very interesting, Ben.
But damn it!
Ben, you go slow on stuff like this, Jack explained. You don't toss out the work of a valuable agent on the basis of equivocal data, and this is equivocal, isn't it?
Technically, yes.
You think he's been turned? Doubled, you mean? Ryan grinned. You're picking up on the jargon, Dr. Goodley. You answer the question for me.
Well,
if he'd been doubled on us, no, he wouldn't send this sort of data. They wouldn't want to send us this kind of signal unless elements within the KGB. Think it through, Ben, Jack cautioned.
Oh, yeah.
It compromises them, too, doesn't it?
You're right, it's not likely.
If he'd been turned, the data should be different.
Exactly.
If you're right, and if he's been misleading us, the most likely explanation is the one you came up with. He stands to profit from the political demise of Narmanov. It helps to think like a cop in this business. Who profits? Who has motive? That's the test you apply here. Best person to look at this is Mary Pat.
Call her in?
Goodley asked. Day like this? Cotty and Gone boarded the flight on the first call, taking their first-class seats and strapping in. 10 minutes later, the aircraft pulled back from the gate and taxied out to the end of the runway. They'd made a smart move, Gone thought. The flight to Dallas had still not been called. 2 minutes after that, the airliner lifted off and soon turned southeast toward the warmer climes of Florida. The maid was having a bad day already.
Most of the guests had left late, and she was way behind on her schedule. She clucked with disappointment at seeing the keep-out card on one doorknob, but it was not on the other connecting room, and she thought it might be a mistake. The flip side of the card was the green make-up room now message, and guests often made that mistake. First, she went into the unmarked one. It was easy. Only one of the beds had been used. She stripped off the linen and replaced it with the speed that came from doing the same job more than 50 times per day. Then she checked out the bathroom, replaced the soiled towels, put a new bar of soap in the holder, and emptied the trash can into the bag that hung from her cart. Then she had to make a decision, whether to make up the other room or not. The card on the knob said no, but if they didn't want it, why didn't they do the same thing for this room? It was worth a look, at least. If anything obviously important was laid out, she'd stay clear. The maid looked through the open connecting door and saw two ordinarily messed up beds. No clothing was on the floors. In fact, the room was as neat today as it had been the day before. She stuck her head through the door and looked back toward the wash area. Nothing remarkable there either. She decided to clean it, too. The maid got behind her cart and turned it to push through the door. Again, she did the beds, then headed back to... How had she missed that before? A man's legs. What? She walked forward and... It took the manager over a minute to calm her down enough to understand what she was saying. Thank God, he thought, that there were no guests on that side of the motel now. All were off to see the game. The young man took a deep breath and walked outside, past the coffee shop and around to the back side of the motel. The door had closed automatically, but his passkey fixed that. My God, he said simply. At least he'd been prepared for it. The manager was no fool. He didn't touch anything, but rather walked into the connecting room and out that door. The desk phone in his office had all the emergency numbers printed on a small card. He punched up the second one. Police, I want to report a murder, the manager said, as calmly as he could manage. President Fowler set the fax down on a corner table and shook his head. It really is unbelievable that he'd try something so blatant. What are you going to do about it? Liz asked. Well, we have to verify it, of course, but I think we'll be able to do that. Brent is flying back from the game tonight. I'll want him in my office early for his advice, but I figure we'll just confront him with it. If he doesn't like it, that's just too damn bad. This is mafia stuff. You really do have a thing about this, don't you? Fowler opened a bottle of beer. Once a prosecutor, always a prosecutor. A hood is a hood is a hood. The JAL 747 touched down at Dulles International Airport 3 minutes early. Out of deference to the weather, and with the approval of the Japanese ambassador, the arrival ceremony was abbreviated. Besides, the sign of a really important arrival in Washington was informality. It was one of the local folkways that the ambassador had explained to the current prime minister's predecessor. After a brief but sincere greeting from Deputy Secretary of State Scott Adler, the official party was loaded into all the four-wheel drive vehicles that the embassy had been able to assemble on such short notice, and headed off to the Madison Hotel, a few blocks from the White House. The president, he learned, was at Camp David and would be coming back to Washington the following morning. The Japanese prime minister, still suffering from the lingering effects of travel, decided to get a few more hours of sleep. He'd not yet taken off his coat when another cleanup crew boarded the aircraft yet again. One man retrieved the unused liquor, including one bottle with a cracked neck. Another emptied the wastebaskets of the various washrooms into a large trash bag. They were soon on their way to Langley. All of the chase aircraft except the first landed at Andrews Air Force Base, where the flight crews also began their mandated rest periods, in this case at the base officers' club. The recordings started their trip to Langley by car, arriving later than the tape recorder from Dulles. It turned out that the machine off the 747 had the best sound quality, and the technicians started on that tape first. The Gulfstream returned to Mexico City, also on time. The aircraft rolled out to the General Aviation Terminal and the flight crew of three, it was an Air Force crew, though no one knew that, walked into the terminal for dinner. Since they were Air Force, it was time for some crew rest. Clark was still at the embassy and planned to catch the first quarter at least before heading back to D.C. and all that damned snow.
"Be careful, or you're going to fall asleep during the game," the National Security Advisor warned.
"It's only my second beer, Elizabeth," Fowler replied. There was a cooler next to the sofa and a large silver tray of munchies. Elliot still found it quite incredible. J. Robert Fowler, President of the United States, so intelligent and hard-minded in every possible way, but a rabid football fan, sitting here like Archie Bunker, waiting for the kickoff.
"I found one, but the other one's a son of a bitch," the crew chief reported. "Can't seem to figure this one out, Colonel."
"Come on inside and warm up," the pilot said. "You've been out here too long anyway."
"Some kind of drug deal, I'll bet you," the junior detective said.
"Then it's amateurs," his partner observed. The photographer had snapped his customary four rolls of film, and now the coroner's men were lifting the body into the plastic bag for transport to the morgue. There could be little doubt on the cause of death. It was a particularly brutal murder. It seemed that the killers, there had to be two, the senior man already thought, had to have held the man's arms down before they slashed his throat, and then they had watched him bleed out while using the towel to keep their clothes clean. Maybe they were paying off a debt somehow or other. Perhaps this guy had done a rip-off, or there was some old grudge that they had settled. This was clearly not a crime of passion. It was far too cruel and calculated for that. The detectives noted their good luck, however. The victim's wallet had still been in his pocket. They had all his ID, and better than that, they had two complete sets of other ID, all of which were now being checked out. The motel records had noted the license numbers of both vehicles associated with these rooms, and those also were being checked on the motor vehicle records computer.
"The guy's an Indian," the coroner's rep said as they picked him up. "Native American, I mean."
"I've seen the face somewhere before," the junior detective thought.
"Wait a minute."
Something caught his eye. He unbuttoned the man's shirt, revealing the top of a tattoo. "He's done time," the senior man said. The tattoo on the man's chest was a crude one, spit and pencil, and it showed something that he'd seen before.
"Wait a minute. This means something. Warrior Society."
"You're right. The feds had something out on...
Oh, yeah, remember? The shooting up in North Dakota last year?"
The senior man thought for a second. "When we get the information from the license, make sure they send it right off to Washington."
"Okay, you can take him out now."
The body was lifted and carried out. "Bring in the maid and the manager." Inspector Pat O'Day had the good luck of drawing watch duty in the FBI's command center, room 5005 of the Hoover Building. The room was oddly shaped, roughly triangular, with the desks of the command staff in the angle and screens on the long wall. The quiet day they were having. There was adverse weather across half the country, and adverse weather is more of an obstacle to crime than any police agency, meant that one of the screens was showing the teams lining up for the coin toss in Denver. Just as the Vikings won the toss and elected to receive, a young lady from communications walked in with a couple of faxes from the Denver PD.
"A murder case, sir. They think we might know who this is."
The quality of photographs on driver's licenses is not the sort to impress a professional anything, and blowing them up, then sending them via fax, didn't improve matters very much. He had to stare at it for a few seconds, and almost decided that he didn't know the face, until he remembered some things from his time in Wyoming.
"I've seen this guy before. Indian. Marvin Russell?"
He turned to another agent.
"Stan, have you ever seen this guy?"
Nope. O'Day looked over the rest of the faxes. Whoever he was dead, with a slashed throat, the Denver cop said. Probable drug-related killing was the initial read from the Denver homicide guys. Well, that made sense, didn't it? John Russell had been part of a drug deal. The other initial data was that there had been other IDs at the scene of the crime, but that the licenses had been fakes. Very good ones, the notes said. However, they had a truck registered to the victim, and also a car at the scene was a rental that had been signed out to Robert Friend, which was the name on the victim's license. The Denver PD was now looking for the vehicles, and he wanted to know if the Bureau had anything useful on the victim and any likely associates.
Get back to him, and tell him to fax us the photos from the other IDs they found.
Yes, sir. Pat watched the teams get onto the field for the kickoff, then lifted the phone.
Dan?
Pat.
You want to come on down here? I think an old friend of ours just might have turned up dead.
No, not that kind of friend. Murray showed up just in time for the kickoff, which took precedence over the faxes. Minnesota got the ball out to the 24-yard line, and their offense went to work. The network immediately had the screen covered with all sorts of useless information so that the fans couldn't see the players.
This looked like Marvin Russell to you?
Pat asked.
Sure as hell does.
Where is he? O'Day waved at the TV screen.
Would you believe Denver?
They found him about 90 minutes ago with his throat cut. Local PD thinks it's drug-related.
Well, that's what did his brother in.
What else? Murray took the faxes from O'Day's hand. Tony Wills got the first handoff, taking the ball 5 yards off tackle, almost breaking it for more. On second down, both men saw Wills catch a swing pass for 20 yards.
That kid is really something, Pat said.
I remember seeing a game where Jimmy Brown... Bob Fowler had just started his third beer of the afternoon, wishing he'd been at the game instead of being stuck here. Of course, the Secret Service would have gone ape, and the security at the game would have to have been beefed up to the point that people would still be trying to get in. That was not a good political move, was it? Liz Elliott, sitting next to the president, flipped one of the other TVs to HBO to catch a movie. She donned a set of headphones so that she could hear it without disturbing the commander-in-chief. It just made no sense at all, she thought. None. How this man could get so enthusiastic about something as dumb as a little boy's game. Pete Dawkins finished his pregame duties by pulling a chain across his gate. Anyone who wanted to get in now would have to use one of the two gates that were still open, but guarded. At the last Super Bowl, a very clever gang of thieves had prowled the parking lot and come away with $200,000 worth of goods from the parked cars, mainly tape decks and radios, and that was not going to happen in Denver. He started his patrol along with three other officers. By agreement, they'd circulate all around the lot instead of sticking to specific areas. It was too cold for that. Moving around would at least keep them warm. Dawkins' legs felt as stiff as cardboard, and moving would loosen them up. He didn't really expect to stop any crimes. What car thief would be so dumb as to prowl around in zero-degree weather? Soon he found himself in the area the Minnesota fans had occupied. They were certainly well organized. The tailgate parties had all ended on time. The lawn chairs were all stowed away, and they'd done a very effective job of cleaning up the area. Except for a few puddles of frozen coffee, you could hardly tell that they had done something here. Maybe the Minnesota fans weren't such idiots after all. Dawkins had a radio plugged into his ear. Listening to a game on the radio was like having sex with your clothes on, but at least he knew what the cheers were about. Minnesota scored first. Wills took it in by sweeping left end from 15 yards out. The Vikings' first drive had taken only 7 plays and 4 minutes 50 seconds. Minnesota sounded pretty tough today.
God, Dennis must be sick, Fowler observed.
Liz didn't hear him, concentrating instead on her movie. The Secretary of Defense immediately had cause to feel sicker. The kickoff was fielded at the 5, and the reserve running back who handled that duty for the Chargers made it all the way to the 40,
but there he fumbled, and a Viking fell on the ball.
They say Marvin was a clever little bastard. Look at the numbers on the other licenses. Except for the first couple of digits, they're the same as his. I bet he got, well, somebody got one of those ID machines, Murray said.
Passports and everything, O'Day replied, watching Tony Wills do it again for 8 yards.
If they don't figure a way to key on that kid, this game's going to be a blowout.
What kind of passports?
They didn't say. I've asked for more information. They'll fax the photos when they get back into the office.
In Denver, the computers were humming. The rental car company was identified, and a check of their system revealed that the car had been returned to Stapleton International Airport just a few hours earlier. That made a really hot trail, and the detectives drove directly there from the motel after taking initial statements from the first pair of witnesses. The descriptions of the other two matched the photos on the passports. These were on their way to police headquarters. Already they knew the FBI was yelling for information. That made it sound more and more like a major drug case. Both detectives wondered where the victim's van was.
Dawkins finished his first circuit of the stadium just as Minnesota made its second touchdown. Again, it was Wills, this time a 4-yard pass out of the backfield. The guy already had 51 yards rushing and 2 receptions. Dawkins found himself looking at the ABC van he'd checked through.
Why the Colorado tags? They said they were from Chicago, and that they had brought the tape widget in from Omaha. But the truck was painted like an official network truck.
The local TV stations were not network-owned. They all showed network affiliation, but the big letters on them were for the local call letters for the stations. Something to ask the Sarge about.
Dawkins circled the entry on his clipboard and wrote a question mark next to it. He walked inside to the security booth.
Where's the Sarge?
Out walking the lot, the officer at the booth replied. The dumbass has 20 bet on the Chargers. I don't think he can take it.
I'll see if I can get him to lay a little more, Dawkins replied with a grin. Which way did he go?
North, I think.
Thanks.
The Vikings kicked off again with the score 14-0. The same return man took the kick, this time 3 yards deep in the end zone. He ignored the safety man's advice to down the ball and went up the middle like a shot. Breaking one tackle at the 16, he took advantage of a picture book block and broke for the sidelines. 15 yards later, it was clear that only the kicker had a chance, but the kicker was slow. At 103 yards, it was the longest kick return in Super Bowl history. The point after was good, and the game was now 14-7.
Feeling better, Dennis? The Secretary of State asked the Secretary of Defense.
Bunker set his coffee down. He had decided not to drink. He wanted to be stone sober when he accepted the Lombardi trophy from the commissioner.
Yeah. Now we just have to figure a way to stop your boy.
Good luck.
He's a great kid, Brent. God damn if he can't run.
He isn't just an athlete. Kid's got brains and a good heart.
Brent, if you educated him, I know he's smart, Bunker said generously. I just wish he'd pull a hamstring right about now.
Dawkins found his sergeant a few minutes later.
Something funny here, he said.
What's that?
This truck. Little white van on the east end of the row of big satellite trucks. ABC painted on it. Colorado commercial tags, but supposedly it's from Chicago or maybe Omaha. I check them through, said they had a tape deck to replace a broken one, but when I walked past it a few minutes ago, it wasn't hooked up, and the guys who brought it in were gone.
What are you telling me? The sergeant asked.
I think it might be a good idea to check it out.
Okay, call it in. I'll give it a walk past.
The sergeant looked at the clipboard to check the tag number.
I was headed off to help out the Wells Fargo guys at the loading dock. You take that for me, okay?
Sure, Sarge.
Dawkins headed off. The watch supervisor lifted his Motorola radio.
Lieutenant Vernon, this is Sergeant Yankovich. Could you meet me down at the TV place?
Yankovich started walking back south around the stadium. He had his own personal radio, but it lacked an earpiece. San Diego stopped the Vikings on downs. Minnesota punted, a good one that required a fair catch at the Chargers' 30. Well, maybe his team could get the game even. Somebody ought to shoot that Wills kid, he thought angrily. Officer Dawkins walked to the north end of the stadium and saw a Wells Fargo armored car parked at the lower-level loading dock. One man was trying to sling out bags of what had to be coins.
What's the problem? The driver's beat his knee up. He's off having it fixed. Can you give me a hand?
Inside or outside? Dawkins asked.
You hand them out, okay? Be careful, they're heavy mothers.
Gotcha. Dawkins hopped inside. The interior of the armored truck was lined with shelves, holding innumerable bags of mainly quarters, it looked like. He lifted one, and it was as heavy as he'd been told. The police officer stuck his clipboard in his belt and went to work, handing them out to the loading dock, where the guard set them on a two-wheel hand truck. Trust the sarge to stick him with this. Yankovic met the lieutenant at the media entrance. Both walked over to the truck in question. The lieutenant looked inside.
A big box with Sony written on it.
Wait a minute. Says it's a commercial videotape machine. Sergeant Yankovic filled his boss in on what Dawkins had told him.
It's probably nothing, but...
Yeah, but... Let me find the ABC guy. I'm also going to call the bomb squad. Stay here and keep an eye on the thing.
I have a Slim Jim in my car. If you want, I can get in easy enough.
Every cop knows how to break into cars.
I don't think so. We'll let the bomb guys think it over. Besides, it's probably just what it looks like.
If they came down to replace a broke tape deck... Well, maybe the broken one was fixed and they decided they didn't need it.
Okay, Lieutenant.
Yankovic walked inside to get another cup of coffee to keep warm, then returned to the out-of-doors he loved so much. The sun was setting behind the Rockies, and even in zero weather and a bitter wind, it was always something beautiful to watch. The police sergeant walked past the network uplink vans to watch the glowing orange ball dip through one of the blowing snow clouds. Some things were better than football. When the last edge of the sun dipped below the ridgeline, he turned back, deciding to take another look at the box inside the truck. He would not make it. Chapter 35. Three Shakes. The timer just outside the bomb case reached 5-0-0-0-0, and things began to happen. First, high-voltage capacitors began to charge, and small pyrotechnics adjacent to the tritium reservoirs at both ends of the bomb fired. These drove pistons, forcing the tritium down narrow metal tubes. One tube led into the primary, the other into the secondary. There was no hurry here, and the objective was to mix the various collections of lithium deuteride with the fusion-friendly tritium atoms. Elapsed time was 10 seconds. At 5-0-0-1-0, the timer sent out a second signal. Time, zero. The capacitors discharged, sending an impulse down a wire into a divider network. The length of the first wire was 50 centimeters. This took 1 2/3 nanoseconds. The impulse entered a dividing network using Crichton switches, each of them a small and exceedingly fast device using self-ionized and radioactive krypton gas to time its discharges with remarkable precision. Using pulse compression to build their amperage, the dividing network split the impulse into 70 different wires, each of which was exactly 1 meter in length. The relayed impulses required 2/10 of a shake, 3 nanoseconds, to transit this distance. The wires all had to be of the same length, of course, because all of the 70 explosive blocks were supposed to detonate at the same instant. With the Crichtons and the simple expedient of cutting each wire to the same length, this was easy to achieve. The impulses reached the detonators simultaneously. Each explosive block had 3 separate detonators, and none of them failed to function. The detonators were small wire filaments, sufficiently thin that the arriving current exploded each. The impulse was transferred into the explosive blocks, and the physical detonation process began 4.4 nanoseconds after the signal was transmitted by the timer. The result was not an explosion, but an implosion, since the explosive force was mainly focused inward. The high explosives blocks were actually very sophisticated laminates of two materials, each laced with dust from light and heavy metals. The outer layer in each case was a relatively slow explosive, with a detonation speed of just over 7,000 meters per second. The explosive wave in each expanded radially from the detonator, quickly reaching the edge of the block. Since the blocks were detonated from the outside in, the blast front traveled inward through the blocks. The border between the slow and fast explosives contained bubbles, called voids, which began to change the shockwave from spherical-shaped to a planar or flat wave, which was focused again to match exactly its metallic target, called drivers. The driver in each case was a piece of carefully shaped tungsten rhenium. These were hit by a force wave traveling at more than 9,800 meters, 6 miles per second. Inside the tungsten rhenium was a 1 centimeter layer of beryllium. Beyond that was a 1 millimeter thickness of uranium-235, which, though thin, weighed almost as much as the far thicker beryllium. The entire metallic mass was driving across a vacuum, and since the explosion was focused on a central point, the actual closing speed of opposite segments of the bomb was 18,600 meters, or 11.5 miles per second. The central aiming point of the explosives and the metallic projectiles was a 10-kilogram, 22-pounds mass of radioactive plutonium-239. It was shaped like a glass tumbler whose top had been bent outwards and down toward the bottom, creating two parallel walls of metal. Ordinarily denser than lead, the plutonium was compressed further by the million atmospheres pressure of the implosion. This had to be done very quickly. The plutonium-239 mass also included a small but troublesome quantity of plutonium-240, which was even less stable and prone to pre-ignition. The outer and inner surfaces were slammed together and driven in turn toward the geometric center of the weapon. The final external act came from a device called a zipper. Operating off the third signal from the still intact electronic timer, the zipper was a miniature particle accelerator, a very compact mini-cyclotron that looked remarkably like a handheld hairdryer. This fired deuterium atoms at a beryllium target. Neutrons traveling 10% of the speed of light were generated in vast numbers and traveled down a metal tube into the center of the primary, called the pit. The neutrons were timed to arrive just as the plutonium reached half of its peak density. Ordinarily, a material weighing roughly twice an equivalent mass of lead, the plutonium was already 10 times denser than that, and still accelerating inward. The bombardment of neutrons entered a mass of still compressing plutonium. Fission. The plutonium atom has an atomic weight of 239, that being the combined number of neutrons and protons in the atomic nucleus. What began happened at literally millions of places at once, but each event was precisely the same. An invading, slow neutron passed close enough to a plutonium nucleus to fall under the strong nuclear force that holds atomic nuclei together. The neutron was pulled into the atom's center, changing the energy state of the host nucleus and kicking it into an unstable state. The once symmetrical atomic nucleus began gyrating wildly and was torn apart by force fluctuations. In most cases, a neutron or proton disappeared entirely, converted to energy in homage to Einstein's law, E equals mc squared. The energy that resulted from the disappearance of the particles was released in the form of gamma and X radiation, or any of 30 or so other but less important routes. Finally, the atomic nucleus released 2 or 3 additional neutrons. This was the important part. The process that had required only 1 neutron to start released 2 or 3 more, each traveling at over 10% of the speed of light, 20,000 miles per second, through space occupied by a plutonium mass 200 times the density of water. The majority of the newly liberated atomic particles found targets to hit. A chain reaction merely means that the process builds on itself, that the energy released is sufficient to continue the process without outside assistance. The fission of the plutonium proceeded in steps called doublings. The energy liberated by each step was double that of the preceding one, and that of each subsequent step was doubled again. What began as a trivial amount of energy and just a handful of freed particles doubled and redoubled, and the interval between steps was measured in fractions of nanoseconds. The rate of increase, that is, the acceleration of the chain reaction, is called the alpha, and is the most important variable in the fission process. An alpha of 1,000 means that the number of doublings per microsecond is a vast number, 2^1,000th power. The number 2 multiplied by itself 1,000 times. At peak fission, between 2^50 and 2^53rd power, the bomb would be generating 10 billion billion watts of power, 100,000 times the electrical generating capacity of the entire world. Frome had designed the bomb to do just that, and that was only 10% of the weapon's total designed output. The secondary had yet to be affected. No part of it had yet been touched by the forces, only a few inches away. But the fission process had scarcely begun. Some of the gamma rays, traveling at the speed of light, were outside the bomb case while the plutonium was still being compressed by the explosives. Even nuclear reactions take time. Other gamma rays started to impact on the secondary. The majority of the gammas streaked through a gas cloud that only a few microseconds earlier had been the chemical explosive blocks, heating it far beyond the temperatures chemicals alone could achieve. Made up of very light atoms like carbon and oxygen, this cloud emitted a vast quantity of low-frequency, soft X-rays. To this point, the device was functioning exactly as Frome and Gohn had planned. The fission process was 7 nanoseconds, 0.7 shakes old, when something went wrong. Radiation from the fissioning plutonium blazed in on the tritium-impregnated lithium deuteride that occupied the geometric center of the pit. The reason Manfred Frome had left the tritium extraction to last lay in his basic engineer's conservatism. Tritium is an unstable gas with a half-life of 12.3 years, meaning that a quantity of pure tritium will, after that time, be composed half of tritium and half of 3He. Called helium-3, 3He is a form of that second lightest of elements whose nucleus lacks an extra neutron and craves another. By filtering the gas through a thin block of palladium, the 3He would have been easily separated out. But Gohn hadn't known about that. As a result, more than a fifth of the tritium was the wrong material. It could hardly have been a worse material. The intense bombardment from the adjacent fission reaction seared the lithium compound. Normally a material half the density of salt, it was compressed to a metallic state that exceeded the density of Earth's core. What began was actually a fusion reaction, though a small one, releasing huge quantities of new neutrons, and also changing many of the lithium atoms into more tritium, which broke down, fused, under the intense pressure to release yet more neutrons. The additional neutrons generated were supposed to invade the plutonium mass, boosting the alpha and causing at least a doubling of the weapon's unboosted fission yield. This had been the first method of increasing the power of the second-generation nuclear weapons. But the presence of 3He poisoned the reaction, trapping nearly a quarter of the high-energy neutrons in uselessly stable helium atoms. For several more nanoseconds, this did not matter. The plutonium was still increasing its reaction rate, still doubling, still increasing its alpha at a rate only expressible numerically. Energy was now flooding into the secondary. The metallically coated straws flashed to plasma, pressing inward on the secondary. Radiant energy in quantities not found on the surface of the sun vaporized, but also reflected off elliptical surfaces, delivering yet more energy to the secondary assembly, called the holram. The plasma from the immolated straws pounded inward toward the second reservoir of lithium compounds. The dense uranium-238 fins just outside the secondary pit also flashed to dense plasma, driving inward through the vacuum, then striking and compressing the tubular containment of more 238U around the central container, which held the largest quantity of lithium deuteride tritium. The forces were immense, and and the structure was pounded with a degree of pressure greater than that of a healthy stellar core. But not enough. The primary's reaction had already slackened. Starved of neutrons by the presence of the 3-HE poison, the bomb's explosive force began to blow apart the reaction mass as soon as the physical forces reached their balance. The chain reaction reached a moment of stability, at last unable to sustain its geometric rate of growth. The last two chain reaction doublings were lost entirely, and what should have been a total primary yield of 70,000 tons of TNT was halved, halved again, and in fact ended with a total yield of 11,200 tons of high explosive. Frome's design had been as perfect as the circumstances and materials allowed. An equivalent weapon less than a quarter the size was possible, but his specifications were more than adequate. A massive safety factor in the energy budget had been planned for. Even a 30-kiloton yield would have been enough to ignite the spark plug in the secondary to start a massive fusion burn. But 30 KT was not reached. The bomb was technically called a fissile. But it was a fissile equivalent to 11,200 tons of TNT. That could be represented by a cube of high explosives 75 feet high, 75 feet long, and 75 feet thick, as much as could be carried by nearly 400 trucks, or one medium-sized ship. But conventional explosives could never have detonated with anything approaching this deadly efficiency. In fact, a conventional explosion of this magnitude is a practical impossibility. For all that, it was still a fizzle. As yet, no perceptible physical effects had even left the bomb case, much less the truck. The steel case remained largely intact, though that would rapidly change. Gamma radiation had already escaped, along with X-rays, but these were invisible. Visible light had not yet emerged from the plasma cloud that had only three shakes before been over 1,000 pounds of exquisitely designed hardware. And yet, everything that was to happen had already taken place. All that remained now was the distribution of the energy already released by natural laws, which neither knew nor cared about the purposes of their manipulators.
Chapter 36. Weapons Effects.
Sergeant Ed Yankovich should have been the first to notice what was happening. His eyes were on the van, and he was walking in that direction, scarcely 40 feet away. But the human nervous system works in milliseconds, and no faster. The fizzle had just ended when the first radiation reached the police officer. These were gamma rays, which are actually photons, the same stuff that light waves are made of, but far more energetic. They were already attacking the body of the truck as well, causing the sheet steel to fluoresce like neon. Immediately behind the gammas were X-rays, also composed of photons, but less energetic. The difference was lost on Yankovich, who would be the first to die. The intense radiation was most readily absorbed by his bones, which rapidly heated to incandescence, while at the same time the neurons of his brain were simultaneously excited as though each had become a flashbulb. In fact, Sergeant Yankovich was unable to notice a thing. He literally disintegrated, exploded from within by the tiny fraction of energy his body was able to absorb as the rest raced through him. But the gammas and X-rays were heading in all possible directions at the speed of light, and their next effect was one no one had anticipated. Adjacent to the van, whose body was now being reduced to molecular bits of metal, was ABC's A satellite unit. Inside were several people who would have no more time to sense their fate than Sergeant Yankovich. The same was true of the elaborate and expensive electrical equipment in the van. But at the rear of this vehicle, pointing south and upward, was a large parabolic dish antenna, not unlike the kind used for radar. In the center of this, like the stamen of a flower, was the waveguide, essentially a metal tube with a square cross-section whose inside dimensions roughly approximated the wavelength of the signal it was now broadcasting to a satellite 22,600 miles over the equator. The waveguide of the A unit and soon thereafter each of the 11 trucks lined up west of it was struck by the gammas and X-rays. In the process, electrons were blasted off the atoms of the metal. In some cases, the guides were lined with gold plate, which accentuated the process, which gave up their energy at once in the form of photons. These photons